Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Before we get going today with our first guest, Susan Glasser from The New Yorker, I just want to briefly mention that this is day two of our annual fall membership drive. And because of the amount of news and the seriousness of the news this fall, we are doing a shorter drive than we usually do in October. It's just now through Friday. Usually we would go through the weekend and into the first part of next week for a total of 9 days. But we don't want to impede the election coverage that much. It's just too important. Or all the local coronavirus information we're trying to keep you abreast of, with rules and schools and neighborhoods changing literally day by day. So we have shortened the drive, and I'll keep this very short. I'm not going to go on about it to start the show, except this one mention. But if you are a regular listener, we hope you'll also be a financial contributor and stand up for independent journalism on WNYC and Gothamist, and stand up for the kind of talk show that this program is, a positive and constructive force, we hope. We try to think of it as remote learning of the airwaves. So if you can, with however a small donation you would like to make, you can do that now on our website at WNYC.org or on the phone at 888-376-WNYC, 888-376-9692, or at WNYC.org. Thank you so much for considering it in this shortened membership drive for a COVID and election season. Now, it's Tuesday, October 20th. 2 weeks before Election Day, around 30 million people have already voted. 29.6 million is the last quote I saw from the Election Project at the University of Florida, which is trying to keep a running tally. The context of that number is in 2016, a total of 130 million people voted in the entire presidential election. So here we are with 30 million votes already cast 2 weeks before what we used to call Election Day. And things we never thought we'd see are happening. The final presidential debate is Thursday night, and the debate commission last night issued a new rule. They will keep the mics off one candidate while the other speaks part of the time, because you know what happened last time. We'll get details on that in a sec. Another thing we thought we'd never see, major Republican figures are beginning to break publicly with the president. Senator John Cornyn of Texas, of all people, told the Fort Worth Star-Telegram editorial board that Trump is like a bad husband. He's, quote, maybe like a lot of women who get married and think they're going to change their spouse, and that doesn't usually work out very well, unquote, from John Cornyn. Trump's former chief of staff, John Kelly, have you heard this one yet, was quoted by CNN in a Sunday night broadcast calling Trump the most flawed person he's ever known. CNN quoted friends of Kelly saying he had told them, quote, the depths of his dishonesty is just astounding to me. The dishonesty, the transactional nature of every relationship, though it's more pathetic than anything else, he is the most flawed person I have ever met in my life, unquote, from his former chief of staff, John Kelly. And then there's Republican Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska, who said this on tape to a group of supporters just the other day in his reelection campaign.
The way he kisses dictators' butts. I mean, the way he ignores that the Uyghurs are in literal concentration camps in Xinjiang right now. He hasn't lifted a finger on behalf of the Hong Kongers. I mean, he and I have a very different foreign policy. It isn't just that he fails to lead our allies. It's that the United States now regularly sells out our allies under his leadership. The way he treats women and spends like a drunken sailor, the ways I criticize President Obama for that kind of spending, I've criticized President Trump for as well. He mocks evangelicals behind closed doors. His family has treated the presidency like a business opportunity. He's flirted with white supremacists.
Senator Ben Sasse at a Republican fundraiser for his own campaign with presumably Republican supporters saying that about the president. Doesn't mean Trump is going to lose, but this amount of distancing by conservative Republicans at this point in a Republican president's reelection campaign, well, try to think of another time. So with that as prelude, we welcome Susan Glasser from The New Yorker. She writes the Letter from Trump's Washington column for The New Yorker every week, and she is also the co-author of a new book, along with her husband, New York Times White House correspondent Peter Baker, called The Man Who Ran Washington, about former Secretary of State and Treasury Secretary and White House Chief of Staff James Baker, no relation to Peter. And hi, Susan, always great to have you on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks so much, Brian. Great to be with you.
So what do you make of Ben Sasse, John Cornyn, and John Kelly saying the things that they've said recently, including Sasse on tape?
Well, you know, I have to say, Brian, I'm sort of conflicted. You know, you hear John Cornyn saying that, but the truth is he stayed in the marriage, no matter how bad it was.
And to further
the real
analogy.
Story is no. That's right. The real story is no divorce. You know, look, if Donald Trump loses, you are definitely going to see a lot of Ben Sasses emerge from the woodwork of their silence of the last 4 years, and they're going to say they never liked the guy, they didn't really support him, they just felt it was best to try to persuade him behind the scenes, which is what John Cornyn also said in that interview. But, you know, the bottom line is these individuals stuck with Trump when it mattered. And the broad story, interestingly, this year is Senate and House Republicans sticking with Donald Trump and making the political calculus that essentially there's nowhere else for them to go, that they have to have the votes of that Republican base, which is essentially made support for Trump, one of their key criteria for supporting any other Republican candidates. So it's a real dilemma for them. We don't know how it ends yet, but I don't think you're going to see a stampede. I do think that clearly Republican senators are very, shall we say, sensitive to how the winds blow. And it's certainly indicative of their fears at this point that Trump may lose.
We already have a listener comment on Twitter that says, how brave of the Republicans to break with Trump now that he's most likely going to lose. But in the John Cornyn context there, does that indicate to you that Texas is actually in play as a swing state in the presidential?
You know, Texas is one of the most fascinating stories of 2020. You know, I've been around long enough to see many predictions of, you know, Texas is turning purple, Texas is turning blue, turn out to not come true. When I was editor of Politico magazine, we ran a cover story about Texas's impending Democratic shift, and that was three election cycles ago. So, you know, Beto O'Rourke showed Democrats are far more competitive than they have been really in a generation in Texas, but of course he didn't win. You know, I've spoken with a number of people about Texas in the last week, and I think there's a sense that it's much more competitive than anyone might have anticipated at the presidential level. But the real story may be down ballot with House races and with Texas state house and state senate races, where you could see Democrats benefiting from higher Democratic turnout, even if Biden doesn't win there.
Your last three New Yorker articles were about the last three debate nights, the Mike Pence-Kamala Harris debate, the first Trump-Biden debate, which your headline was Notes from the Worst Debate in American History, and the dueling town halls last week that you said were Mr. Rogers versus Nasty Uncle. So now we have the final debate coming on Thursday night with the Debate Commission's new rule issued just last night about turning the candidates' microphones off at certain times. Is it clear to you exactly when they'll do that?
No, it actually isn't, because, you know, I believe the rules specify that it's in the first opening 2 minutes that each candidate gets. There is a period after that reserved for open debate. And it's not clear to me how that's going to go at all. And of course, you have President Trump, who continues to believe, you know, A, that he should be answering every question, and B, you know, that if he rattles Biden, that Biden will lose his train of thought, or that he'll stutter. You know, they're openly attacking the former vice president for this in a way that is sort of astonishing. But, you know, just this morning on Fox and Friends, before Donald Trump phoned in, there was a guest actually attacking the vice president's stutter. And so I think this is the strategy. Sometimes it's not hidden, but hidden in plain sight.
When I heard that last night about the new rule, I thought, well, maybe Trump will bail again like he did on the second debate when they wanted to make it virtual and choose to have a grievance rather than a debate. But instead, the campaign reaffirmed that he will attend. What's your political analysis of that?
look, Donald Trump is the guy who's losing. Donald Trump is the guy who's behind. And at this point, you know, he needs the national television audience. You know, he's out there wall to wall, but essentially he's mostly speaking to the converted and to us journalists who have to listen, whatever platform he's on. Right. He's traveling around the country to rallies of people who already fervently support him. He's appearing on Fox, almost all of their shows over and over again, and he's on Rush Limbaugh. You know, so he needs, if he's going to have a chance at winning, he needs to appear in some sort of setting in which he's speaking not just to people who are already planning to vote for him. So I think as a challenger, in effect, which is what he is, it's pretty hard for him to turn down that platform.
Susan Glasser with us, who writes the Letter from Trump's Washington column for The New Yorker. She's also the author of a new book, along with White House correspondent for The New York Times, Peter Baker, and they happen to be married. And the new book is called The Man Who Ran Washington, about former Secretary of State and Treasury Secretary and Chief of Staff to George W. Bush and Ronald Reagan, variously. James Baker of Texas. People of a certain age will remember how prominent Baker was. And you portray him, Susan, as a real deal maker compared to Trump, who's really a rejectionist but portrays himself as a deal maker. Now, Baker is still alive, and you said he struggles with what to do about Trump. What's James Baker's struggle?
Well, look, you know, he just turned 90 this year. You know, I think one of the interesting things about working on this biography for a long time was watching the sort of parallel rise of Donald Trump. And that was the backup of many conversations we had with Secretary Baker over the last 5 years. He, like his party, you know, really felt this was a hostile takeover, in effect, by Donald Trump. He is completely opposed to much of what Baker and other Republicans see as the core values of their party, or were the core values of their party, things like free trade, internationalism, working with allies. And of course, Baker, widely considered by Democrats as well as Republicans, the gold standard as White House chief of staff for Reagan and for Bush, you know, offended by the sheer sort of incompetence and dysfunction of the Trump administration, but very torn about what to do about it. And he very reluctantly did vote for Trump 4 years ago. At one point, he told us he was considering voting for Biden this year. But then he a couple of months later, he said, no, don't say that. I'm still a Republican, even if my party has left me.
You know, on Sunday night on the WNYC program, The United States of Anxiety with Kai Wright, he and former conservative talk show host Charlie Sykes were discussing how much the last 50 years of mainstream Republicanism led to Trump, rather than Trump being such an aberration from it and the party leaving people like James Baker, as you just quoted him saying. I hope you don't let James Baker off the hook in that regard, but how do you see him?
Look, I think that if you ask somebody the same question over and over again and they give you the same answer, you have to listen, right? If somebody tells you who they are, listen. He chose, in the end, a definition of partisanship and wanted to be remembered primarily as a Republican. And that I think, is very telling. Why, if you want to understand what is going on in the country right now and why 40%, 41%, 44% of Americans are still voting for Donald Trump, even in the midst of a pandemic with so many dead, even in the midst of economic chaos that the federal government is essentially doing nothing about at this moment in time, I think it tells you a lot. It's a very revealing insight into what today's Republican Party is. One final thought, though, Brian. The difference is, in the time in which Baker operated, in the 80s and early 90s, the end of the Cold War, we didn't have the luxury of just sitting around and doing nothing. And while he was very partisan in election years, in non-election years, he sat down and he made real deals with Democrats, because that's who you had to deal with. They reformed Social Security. They reformed the tax code in 1986 with Democrats and Republicans working together. The first thing that they did after the very partisan scorched earth campaign against Michael Dukakis in 1988 was to sit down with Jim Wright, the Democratic Speaker of the House, and to find a way to end U.S. support for the Contra Wars, and the most divisive foreign policy issue of the 1980s. So, well, the difference is that governing doesn't work anymore.
Let me push you on this a little bit, and I haven't read your book yet, but James Baker helped get us into the first Iraq War. admitting that it was a war for oil, but saying that was okay. He enabled Reagan's culture war presidency. My own sense of the arc is that it has very much led to Trump on racial polarization, on, quote, law and order, on the way they politicize patriotism, not that it's been an aberration over the last 4 years. What about your sense?
Well, you know, Brian, that's the history that we're examining in the book. And interestingly, you know, whatever you make of it, Baker was actually on the other side of all those internal fights in the very, you know, sort of backstabbing Reagan world. He was the one who was the anti-culture warrior. He was the one who, you know, said to focus on things like the economy and ultimately on getting deals done like tax reform. So, you know, the sort of movement conservatives were always very, very suspicious of the Bakers, the pragmatists, the people who wanted to figure out how to work with Democrats, the people who brought Tip O'Neill in to make deals with Ronald Reagan. That was sort of the Baker faction. It's interesting. It won arguably in the short term and lost in the long term, right? That Republican Party that you describe is ascendant, is the one that won. But part of the history we're learning is how, you know, you had this sort of master tactician and fixer who was on the other side of all those internal fights.
Susan, how are you anticipating election counting going? Let me give you a smattering of headlines from swing states from the New York Times in the last day. In Pennsylvania, election officials are staring down possibly the biggest ballot processing backlog in the country, with no means of even touching the absentee ballots until polls open on Election Day. Because of a late start to counting, Michigan anticipates being one of the last states to report full results, with election officials estimating that is unlikely to happen before Friday, November 6th. And in North Carolina, thousands of submitted absentee ballots are currently in purgatory, neither rejected nor accepted, but, quote, under review amid a back-and-forth court battle over so-called ballot curing. So, oh my goodness, Susan, for some of those scenarios, and those are in three of the most important swing states, what are you expecting in 2 weeks?
Well, that's right. It gives new new definition to the term election night, if it's going to be election week or election weeks or election months. And I think, you know, a lot of the preemptive anxiety we're all feeling is not only just sort of flashbacks to 2016, but also I think a very real and palpable sense of the unknown as far as what's the process by which we're even going to arrive at an outcome. You know, I would throw in even the Supreme Court uncertainty, right? You have Republicans moving ahead right now with pushing through a ninth Supreme Court justice last night. We saw the importance that could make, because there was a 4-4 Supreme Court decision that essentially left intact and gave a victory to Democrats. So what if the fifth justice arrives to change that outcome of those election cases? And so I think we're really looking at a period of uncertainty about who's actually going to be able to vote, whose votes will count, and realizing we might not and are likely not to go to bed on election night with an outcome. The only way that isn't the case, of course, is if one of the candidates, and that would likely be Biden at this point in time, were able to win a decisive enough victory that even were all absentee votes counted, it wouldn't change the outcome. That's hard to see in a state like North Carolina, where the polls, I just saw this morning, the polls are 2 points, essentially within the margin of error.
Yeah. And this brings us back to James Baker in a way, because one thing that he got very involved with was the Bush versus Gore Florida post-election day battle in 2000 that, of course, ended at the Supreme Court. And you portray this as Baker was so good at being a fixer that once he got into the battle on the Bush side, the Gore people were more worried than they were before. So what was Baker's role? But for the present, what lesson does it provide, perhaps, for what to expect this year from anyone?
Well, it is interesting. We definitely spoke with Democrats who said as soon as they knew that it was going to be Baker up against Warren Christopher, that they had a pretty good sense that that the Republicans would have the advantage in that. But, you know, look, in reality, of course, it was the Supreme Court that made the decision. And even the Republicans, interestingly, were not 100% convinced when they took it to the court what the outcome of those votes would be. You know, Baker in this story is a story about not standing on principle, and, you know, that winning was his goal as he defined it. It was the only goal as he defined it. And he was willing to do things that went up against Republican orthodoxy. You know, there's a very strong predisposition among Republicans to keep things in the state courts, to let the state courts to decide, you know, a state election dispute. But Baker saw right away that that probably wasn't going to work out very well in Florida, where the entire Florida Supreme Court at that time had been appointed by Democrats. And he pushed them successfully, as it turned out, just to go ahead and go right into federal court. So, you know, he had a very clear sense that he was there as a lawyer representing a client, and that winning was essentially the only goal.
Susan Glasser writes the letter from Trump's Washington column for The New Yorker every week and is now co-author of the book about James Baker, the man who ran Washington. Susan, we always appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Brian, great to talk with you. Thank you.